This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Yesterday morning, FBI agents in San Antonio, Texas, released information about 23-year-old Mark Anthony Condit, the man who killed two and injured four in a series of bombings in and around Austin, Texas. In incidents like these, lone wolf terrorists, everybody wants to know the motivations of the perpetrator. But the FBI did not release the audio confession made by Condit hours before he committed suicide on March the 20th as authorities closed in. The explanation for holding on to the confession is that authorities don't want elements to be spread on the internet. But what does cause a person to move from hateful thoughts to violent action? This Friday, the University of Cincinnati College of Law is hosting an all-day symposium entitled Lone Wolf Terrorism and Self-Radicalization. I am joined today by the academic director of the Glenn M. Weaver Institute of Law and Psychiatry at the College of Law, Dr. Valerie Hardcastle, the director of forensic psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Christopher Merritt, and Mark Fulman, the national affairs editor of Mother Jones. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email at wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's nice to have you. Certainly a timely topic, to put it mildly. So what's, Valerie, let's begin with just what's the definition of lone wolf terrorist? What differentiates this kind of terrorist from others, and what even makes a person a terrorist?
Both very good questions. So what makes a lone wolf or a lone actor terrorist? Lone is that they become radicalized essentially on their own. So
it's not just the act, it's also the process that leads up to that.
It's the process that leads up to it. So they are not technically affiliated with any known terrorist organizations, which is not to say that they don't interact with them over the internet or something like that. But they're not recruited in particular by terrorist organizations. And oftentimes all of this happens over the internet. And so they don't even meet up with other members of their ideological perspective. Now, what makes someone a terrorist as opposed to perhaps just a very violent person is that these people engage in violence for some political reason or some political outcome that they're hoping for. So they're motivated to engage in their terroristic activities because they believe that the government is doing something really bad and very wrong, and this is the only way that they can see to stop it.
So this has to be a political act, not just a personal revenge act.
That's correct. That's what makes it a terrorist as opposed to
And is that part of what was going on in Austin, where there seemed to be a reluctance to label what was happening with those bombings terrorism for a while on the part of the at least the local police?
I think so. And certainly I think, particularly given the public hype around terrorism, law enforcement would be reluctant to label anything terrorist unless they were very sure of the motivations of the perpetrator.
Mark Fulman, I asked this question to try to get a handle a little bit. I don't know what the answers are possible. Demographically, how are lone wolf terrorists similar or different than other types of terrorists, people who are members of a group, of an organized group? Is there any way to say they have certain characteristics that somewhat distinguish them from people who are members of groups?
You know, I think the term terrorism has become pretty fluid in some ways recently in this discussion. How do you define what an act of terror is or who a terrorist is? This comes up in a legal context in terms of the way that government classifies attacks. But I think it's become more difficult to distinguish in some ways how we talk about this. But I do think that we're in an era now where we're seeing a rise of extreme political ideology, political extremism, of multiple times. And it seems to me that considering it in those terms makes more sense, regardless of where it is on the spectrum. And while I think in general the public perceives the concept of terrorism as being related to groups and typically foreign groups, you know, best known, of course, in the post 9/11 era as being radical Islamist terrorism, we have seen quite an uptick in the last couple years in, I think, what can be credibly called far-right terrorism. People involved in far-right political extremist groups who are committing violent attacks.
Okay. Dr. Merritt, have there been opportunities either that you've been able to conduct or others have been able to conduct of sitting down and doing one-on-one interviews with people who have, I don't know, been lone wolf actors, lone wolf terrorists, so that we get past the data, the trends, the generalization, so you can begin to see what a person is, what really drives them, motivates them, leads them to where they take action and they take violent action?
Yes, there have. Certainly, it can be a challenge when these events happen and the person has succumbed to the event, has died during it. But there are times where either the plot was foiled or the person survived and they've been interviewed. One of the experts that is presenting at our symposium on Friday has devoted much of his career to that study, Dr. Reed Malloy. And based on his work with these folks, has developed a framework to help the public understand some of the psychological motivations and some of the warning signs for this sort of behavior.
And what would those be? I mean, how unusual would these be?
Well, his tool has looked at it in terms of very similar to a tornado watch versus a tornado warning. So what are the things that lead up in the months and weeks to the preparation of an event? And then what are the things that are concerning where someone should intervene very close to the time of the event? Certainly, an extreme political ideology is one of the underlying factors. Failure to meet different milestones in a person's life is important. So a failure of intimate relationships, a failure of having a work and occupational life, some of those can be distant warning signs or kind of a tornado watch to this event occurring.
Okay. When we say lone actors or lone terrorists, does that mean that these people never reveal that they're going to what they're going to do or what their intentions might be to anybody? Or are there ways of taking those general trends Dr. Merritt just talked about and beginning to say, ooh, this person maybe is trying to tell me something is about to happen?
Yes, it's actually quite the opposite of that. That is one of the largest warning signs that this tool looks at is when a person communicates that threat. The term that Dr. Malloy uses is leakage. So if someone directly communicates a threat, that's a time for threat managers to intervene, especially if the threat is directly communicated to the intended target.
And there have been instances, I think, of lone wolf terrorists who even authorities had gotten warnings of but didn't sort of lost track in the midst of all the other information they had and didn't necessarily pick up on it. Is that right?
Yes, that can be a challenge. If there is so much information, it can become difficult to sort out. And unfortunately, again, this tool that is being used helps you look at things that are of higher concern. Okay, at this point, rather than monitoring someone's internet activity or monitoring what they're doing in the community, this is the time to intervene.
Dr. Hardcastle, is this a growing trend? I mean, I know we're paying a lot of attention to it, but again, statistically, is there something that says, oh, this was the beginning of a trend and we're now at this stage and yes, it's growing or it sort of has leveled out or whatever the line is?
It is actually a growing trend, particularly in the United States, and it really started about mid-2000. So following the 9/11 tragedy, the United States obviously, dumped a lot of resources into dismantling terrorist networks overseas. And they've been actually quite successful in that. As a result, it's much more difficult for overseas organizations to put together a very complex plan to wreak havoc in the United States. And one of the things that has, in a sense, filled that void is that people are able to communicate with now these kind of rough and ready, very loose affiliations overseas. And the people overseas can take advantage of the people in the United States to kind of prompt them to take some sort of radical act or some act of violence in the United States. And so there's been a significant uptick since about 2005.
And has that resulted in increased numbers of deaths, increased numbers of injuries, or is it just the numbers of attempts?
What I've been tracking is the numbers of attempts. I don't actually have data on the numbers of deaths, but maybe some of the other participants here do.
Mark Fulman with Mother Jones, it's very easy to, in the post 9/11 world, to think that terrorism is somehow really directly connected to radical Islamic jihadist movements. What have your reporting, what are you finding that in the United States are the sources of these terrorist acts especially by lone wolves, lone actors?
Well, I think as I was suggesting before, it's a continuum, right? Certainly in the era of ISIS, and I think what Dr. Hardcastle was just referring to in terms of the increased activity around foreign entities trying to inspire so-called homegrown attacks, we've certainly seen a rise of that over recent years. And then also at the other end of the spectrum, politically with far-right extremism, we've seen, I think, a significant rise in plots and attacks. I've actually been working on a data set. It's not public yet, but I've found at least a dozen cases over the last year plus where we've seen different types of attacks. Now, I think it's important to note that, when you're talking about motive in public attacks, it's a very complex equation in most cases. So I think we need to be careful about attributing political ideology as a cause. But that said, I do think there's been a rise in cases where we can see this kind of political extremism as a factor. And to the question of lone operator, I mean, I think it's murky there too, right? Because we see people who are identifying with groups. Does it necessarily mean that there's some kind of organized or strategic planning that goes into it? Not necessarily. But if you look, for example, just at what happened in Charlottesville last August, it's interesting there to think about too, the person who drove a car into a crowd and killed a young protester and injured 19 other people. Interesting to think about the tactic used there too. That's a vehicular attack like that is something that previously we'd associated almost exclusively with radical Islamic terrorism attacks. So I think a lot of this stuff has started to blend together in some new ways that merit further research and investigation.
Given what we've just been talking about there between what's really motivating these lone actors, and Mark sort of raised this question, what is the relationship of the political rhetoric? I mean, these have to be political acts. Dr. Hardcastle made that clear at the beginning. But what is the relationship of the political rhetoric and sort of individual personal motivation to make an act, express themselves, to just make an impact on society? What are we dealing with here? How important are those two different forces?
Both are quite important. Certainly, everyone's motivation is different. And as Mr. Fulman pointed out, the different factors that lead up to that are different. One interesting statistic in the research that I mentioned is that lone actor terrorists are 13 times more likely to have a mental disorder than those that are directed by a terrorist organization. So that's one example of the individual variation among these folks.
And when we say mental disorder, because so often after a shooting a mass shooting, you know, people say, oh, well, it's mental health. There's a mental health problem here. I mean, when you use that term, do you have something specific in mind, something that can be clinically diagnosed?
Exactly. Something that is standard clinical diagnosable. In psychiatry, we use a book called the DSM, which sets definitions of how we come up with a clinical diagnosis.
So we're not just talking about somebody who is a little bit off, a little bit strange. I mean, we can't blame – I think we just have to be cautious about how we label some things.
Certainly, and we have to be cautious not to dichotomize it as a question of was this a result of mental illness or not. I think there is room in between, and that's why it's helpful to have mental health experts involved in trying to sort that out.
Mark Fulman, what is the relationship between, and you've talked several times this afternoon already, about far-right extremism and the general change, not in the specifics of that, but the way the culture has changed maybe over the last 2.5, 3 years, and to be specific, with the Trump campaign and rhetoric, how does the general mood in society impact these individuals? How does that filter down?
Sure. Well, I think it goes to what you were just discussing, and it is a real point of interest and concern, I think. It's difficult to measure in the broader realm of threat assessment when you're trying to understand what motivates a person to go out and commit a public attack. It's complicated, but having tracked mass shootings now for more than 6 years, I've definitely noticed an uptick in the last couple years of political ideology in the mix. It's not that it wasn't there before. There are certainly cases going farther back where you see it. But I do believe that we're seeing an increase in it. And there is a correlation, I think. I mean, it certainly bears further exploration to the way that our politics has shifted in this, you know, so-called Trump era. And it's not exclusive to far-right politics. There have been cases of attacks with different kinds of ideological motivations, too. You can look at the police shootings that happened in 2016 in Dallas and in Baton Rouge, which seem to be in part motivated by anti-police factors in the perpetrators. But I also think that we have to acknowledge that the political rhetoric that came out of the Trump campaign and then entered into the White House in terms of, you know, tribalism and singling out groups, singling out Muslims, if you remember at the outset of the administration, you know, we've seen cases where people have been attacked with that motivation as a factor. Bombing of a mosque in Minnesota, that case just recently brought charges for three alleged perpetrators who, according to federal prosecutors, declared that they wanted to send a message to Muslims to get the hell out of the country. So I think we are seeing some direct connections of the rhetoric of the 2016 election and some of these cases now.
What do all of these studies and the analysis of what this is, how does this impact policy? And how does this impact what various government agencies should be doing in terms of responding to this?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. And part of that has to do with what both Mark Fulman and Chris Merritt have been discussing, which is so much of what goes into making a person a terrorist is very individual. And so I think it's very hard to devise effective policies at a global level. However, that being said, I think being able to monitor particularly activity in social media and look for flags is very important. And then the question is, as Dr. Merritt had mentioned, how and when do you intervene? Because there is a big difference between somebody entertaining violent thoughts, which we all probably do at some point in our lives, versus actually engaging in a violent act. And the key, I think, is going to be to figure out exactly when it is somebody's moving from violent thoughts to violent acts.
Dr. Merritt, you are a forensic psychiatrist. What's that? What's the first part of that identification mean, forensic?
Yes. Well, the second part of it is psychiatrist is a medical doctor who specializes in the treatment of mental health conditions. And forensic just means the application of that knowledge of mental health to questions that attorneys or courts have with a legal bearing on mental health.
So following up on what we were just talking about, do you have any confidence in the ability to predict? I mean, it's one thing to see after the fact, but to say, I think this person really has potential here to be violent to themselves, to others. Is there anything there that we can see?
That's an excellent question. In general terms, it is very difficult to predict who will act and when they will act. Much of the literature in forensic psychiatry is devoted to figuring out risk factors. Okay, so if someone is doing this, they are at higher risk. But in terms of predicting when a particular act will happen, that's very difficult. That being said, and getting back to one of your previous questions, one thing we're seeing more of now is the role for a different subspecialty called organizational psychologists. An example of this is that at many college campuses, we have teams now where they proactively look for risks. They want to prevent the next school shooting, the next campus attack. And so it's often involves law enforcement, psychologists, campus officials, and it's a coordinated effort to try to track this.
And is that showing some merit?
It's difficult to show which attacks were thwarted, A, because it's not released publicly, and B, sometimes you don't know whether it would have happened or not. But in general, it is something that is becoming more popular.
Given that Mark Zuckerberg's in Washington right now testifying about people's information on Facebook and how it's used, I throw this out to any of the three of you who want to tackle it. I mean, with these powerful algorithms we've got, and to try to see, you can track a lot of what people are saying. There can be keywords that start showing up. Is there a role to play in having big data analysis used to try to cut off these, identify and cut short these lone actors? And within the role of the legal system? Let me just throw that in to make it even more complicated.
So I think the short answer is yes. But the real challenge is that there's so much data out there and so many people are so ugly on social media, as we all know, that the legal and law enforcement personnel are simply overwhelmed by the potential activity out there. And I don't think we've perfected being able to tell someone who's just being, you know, ugly and snarky versus someone who's really serious about committing a violent act. And so if then law enforcement has to investigate everything, we simply don't have the people to do it. So I think the challenge is actually not getting the data or even analyzing the data. It's that we have so much of it and we don't have enough people to be able to do something with it.
Mark, do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I agree with, and I would add that there is a very big question on the table that's corollary to this right now on Capitol Hill today, which is the advent of so-called fake news and this deepening problem of lack of public trust and perception of what is real. And I think that that's a major societal issue we're grappling with now that has relevance to this. You can look at examples specifically, like take the phony story of the so-called Pizzagate scandal that happened during the 2016 election, where you had this completely phony conspiracy theory being pushed across social media to very extensive effect. to the point where you have a person drive in a car from North Carolina to Washington, D.C. and fire a gun in a restaurant. So we've seen evidence already that people are susceptible to the kind of, you know, dark and disturbing and misleading content that has become so prevalent on social media. That's a problem here, too, in terms of the role of social media in affecting certain subset of individuals who may be inclined to move towards a violent attack.
Well, I find that all interesting, especially in light, since they can figure out from my analysis of my Facebook posts what advertisements to post at me. But you know, it's that double-edged sword. I want to thank all of three of you for being here today. You're going to have this conference on Friday. There is information on our website if people want to attend, and it's open to people who are not just experts, but who are the general public. Is that right?
That is correct.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, and good luck with the conference on Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.